a pleasing rhythm, but emotionally jolting.
"We have had a great deal of difficulty obtaining Ubik of late,"
he said as he flowed back. In his right hand, he held a flat leaded tin, which he placed before Joe on the prescription counter.
"This comes in the form of a powder to which you add coal tar. The coal tar comes separate. I can supply that to you at very little cost. The Ubik powder, however, is dear. $40.
"What's in it?" Joe asked. The price chilled him.
"That is the manufacturer's secret."
Joe picked up the sealed tin and held it to the light.
"Is it all right if I read the label?"
"Of course."
In the dim light entering from the street, he at last managed to make out the printing on the label of the tin. It continued the handwritten message on the traffic citation, picking up at the exact point at which Runciter's writing had abruptly stopped. "Absolutely untrue. She did not, repeat, not try to use her talent following the bomb blast. She did not try to restore Wendy Wright, or Al Hammond, or Edie Dorn. She's lying to you, Joe, and that makes me rethink the whole situation. I'll let you know as soon as I come to a conclusion. Meanwhile, be very careful. By the way, Ubik powder is of universal healing value if directions for use are rigorously and conscientiously followed."
"Can I make you out a check?" Joe asked the druggist. "I don't have $40 with me, and I need the Ubik badly. It's literally a matter hanging between life and death."
He reached into his jacket pocket for his checkbook.
"You're not from Des Moines, are you?"
the druggist said.
"I can tell by your accent. No, I'd have to know you to take a check that large. We've had a whole rash of bad checks the last few weeks, all by people from out of town."
"Credit card, then?"
the druggist said.
"What is a credit card?"
Laying down the tin of Ubik, Joe turned and walked wordlessly out of the drugstore onto the sidewalk. He crossed the street, starting in the direction of the hotel, then paused to look back at the drugstore. He saw only a dilapidated yellow building, curtains in its upstairs windows, the ground floor boarded up and deserted. Through the spaces between the boards, he saw gaping darkness, the cavity of a broken window, without life.
"And that is that,"
he realized.
"The opportunity to buy a tin of Ubik powder is gone, even if I were to find $40 lying on the pavement. But," he thought, "I did get the rest of Runciter's warning, for what it's worth. It may not even be true. It may be only a deformed and misguided opinion by a dying brain, or by a totally dead brain, as in the case of the TV commercial." "Christ," he said to himself dismally. "Suppose it is true."
Persons here and there on the sidewalk stared up absorbedly at the sky. Noticing them, Joe looked up too. Shielding his eyes against the slanting shafts of sun, he distinguished a dot exuding white trails of smoke, a high-flying monoplane industriously skywriting. As he and the other pedestrians watched, the already dissipating streamers spelled out a message. "Keep the old Swizer up, Joe."
"Easy to say," Joe said to himself. "Easy enough to write out in the form of words."
Hunched over with uneasy gloom, and the first faint intimations of returning terror, he shuffled off in the direction of the Marmont Hotel. Don Denny met him in the high-ceilinged, provincial, crimson-carpeted lobby.
"We found her,"
he said.
"It's all over. For her, anyhow. And it wasn't pretty. Not pretty at all. Now Fred Zasky is gone. I thought he was in the other car. They thought he went along with us. Apparently he didn't get into either car. He must be back at the mortuary."
"It's happening faster now," Joe said.
He wondered how much difference Ubik, dangled toward them again and again in countless different ways, but always out of reach, would have made.
"I guess we'll never know," he decided.
"Can we get a drink here?"
he asked Don Denny.
"What about money? Mine's worthless."
"The mortuary is paying for everything. Runciter's instructions to them."
"The hotel tab, too?" It struck him as odd. How had that been managed?
"I want you to look at this citation,"
he said to Don Denny, while no one else is with us. He passed the slip of paper over to him. I have the rest of the message. That's where I've been, getting it. Denny read the citation, then reread it, then slowly handed it back to Joe.
Runciter thinks Pat Conley is lying,
he said.
Yes,
Joe said.
You realize what that would mean?
His voice rose sharply.
It means she could have nullified all this, everything that's happened to us, starting with Runciter's death.
Joe said, it could mean more than that. Eyeing him, Denny said,
you're right. Yes, you're absolutely right.
He looked startled, and then acutely responsive. Awareness glittered in his face, of an unhappy, stricken kind.
I don't particularly feel like thinking about it, Joe said. I don't like anything about it. It's worse, a lot worse than what I thought before, what Al Hammond believed, for example, which was bad enough.
But this could be it,
Denny said.
Throughout all that's been happening, Joe said, I've kept trying to understand why. I was sure if I knew why... But Al never thought of this, he said to himself. Both of us let it drop out of our minds, for a good reason.
Denny said,
don't say anything to the rest of them. This may not be true, and even if it is, knowing it isn't going to help them.
Knowing what?
Pat Conley said from behind them.
What isn't going to help them?
She came around in front of them now, her black, color-saturated eyes, wise and calm. Serenely calm.
It's a shame about Edie Dorn, she said. And Fred Zavsky. I guess he's gone, too. That doesn't really leave very many of us, does it? I wonder who'll be next.
She seemed undisturbed, totally in control of herself.
Tippy is lying down in her room. She didn't say she felt tired, but I think we must assume she is. Don't you agree?
After a pause, Don Denny said,
yes, I agree.
How did you make out with your citation, Joe?
Pat said. She held out her hand.
Can I take a look at it?
Joe passed it to her.
The moment, he thought, has come. Everything is now, rolled up into the present, into one instant.
How do the policemen know my name?
Pat asked, after she had glanced over it. She raised her eyes, looked intently at Joe, and then at Don Denny.
Why is there something here about me?
She doesn't recognize the writing,
Joe said to himself.
Because she's not familiar with it, as the rest of us are.
Runciter, he said.
You're doing it, aren't you, Pat?
He said.
It's you, your talent. We're here because of you.
And you're killing us off,
Don Denny said to her.
One by one. But why?
To Joe, he said,
what reason could she have? She doesn't even know us, not really.
Is this why you came to Runciter Associates?
Joe asked her. He tried but failed to keep his voice steady. In his ears it wavered, and he felt abrupt contempt for himself.
Gigi Ashwood scouted you and brought you in. Was he working for Hollis? Is that it? Is that what really happened to us? Not the bomb blast, but you?
Pat smiled. And the lobby of the hotel blew up in Joe Chip's face. 13.
Lift your arms and be all at once curvier. New extra gentle Ubik bra and long line Ubik special bra mean lift your arms and be all at once curvier. Supplies firm, relaxing support to bosom all day long, when fitted as directed.
Darkness hummed about him, clinging to him like coagulated, damp, warm wool. The terror he had felt as intimation fused with the darkness became whole and real.
I wasn't careful, he realized. I didn't do what Runciter told me to do. I let her see the citation.
What's the matter, Joe?
Don Denny's voice edged with great worry.
What's wrong?
I'm okay.
He could see a little now. The darkness had grown horizontal lines of gray, as if it had begun to decompose.
"I just feel tired,"
he said, and realized how really tired his body had become. He could not remember such fatigue, never before in his life. Don Denny said,
"Let me help you to a chair."
Joe felt his hand clamped over his shoulder. He felt Denny guiding him, and this made him afraid, this need to be led. He pulled away.
"I'm okay," he repeated.
The shape of Denny had started to form near him. He concentrated on it, then once again distinguished the turn-of-the-century lobby with its ornate crystal chandelier and its complicated yellow light.
"Let me sit down,"
he said, and groping, found a cane-bottomed chair. To Pat, Don Denny said harshly,
"What did you do to him?"
"She didn't do anything to me,"
Joe said, trying to make his voice firm, but it dipped shrilly, with unnatural overtones.
"As if it speeded up," he thought. "High-pitched. Not my own."
"That's right," Pat said. "I didn't do anything to him or to anybody else."
Joe said,
"I want to go upstairs and lie down."
"I'll get you a room,"
Don Denny said nervously. He hovered near Joe, appearing and then disappearing as the lights of the lobby ebbed. The light waned into dull red, then grew stronger, then waned once more.
"You stay there in that chair, Joe. I'll be right back."
Denny hurried off in the direction of the desk. Pat remained.
"Anything I can do for you?"
Pat asked pleasantly.
"No,"
he said. It took vast effort, saying the word aloud. It clung to the internal cavern lodged in his heart, a hollowness which grew with each second.
"A cigarette, maybe,"
he said, and saying the full sentence exhausted him. He felt his heart labor. The difficult beating increased his burden. It was a further weight pressing down on him, a huge hand squeezing.
"Do you have one?"
he said, and managed to look up at her through the smoky red light, the fitful, flickering glow of an unrobust reality.
"Sorry," Pat said. "No got."
Joe said,
"What's the matter with me?"
"Cardiac arrest, maybe," Pat said.
"Do you think there's a hotel doctor?"
he managed to say.
"I doubt it."
"You won't see? You won't look?"
Pat said,
"I think it's merely psychosomatic. You're not really sick. You'll recover."
Returning, Don Denny said,
"I've got a room for you, Joe. On the second floor, room 203.
He paused, and Joe felt his scrutiny, the concern of his gaze.
"Joe, you look awful. Frail. Like you're about to blow away. My God, Joe, do you know what you look like? You look like Edie Dorn looked when we found her."
"Oh, nothing like that," Pat said. "Edie Dorn is dead. Joe isn't dead. Are you, Joe?"
Joe said,
"I want to go upstairs. I want to lie down."
Somehow he got to his feet. His heart thudded, seemed to hesitate, to not beat for a moment, and then it resumed, slamming like an upright iron ingot crashing against cement. Each pulse of it made his whole body shudder.
"Where's the elevator?"
he said.
"I'll lead you over to it,"
Denny said, again his hand clamped over Joe's shoulder.
"You're like a feather,"
Denny said.
"What's happening to you, Joe? Can you say? Do you know? Try to tell me."
"He doesn't know," Pat said.
"I think you should have a doctor,"
Denny said.
"Right away."
"No,"
Joe said.
"Lying down will help me,"
he said to himself. He felt an oceanic pull, an enormous tide tugging at him. It urged him to lie down. It compelled him toward one thing alone, to stretch out, on his back, alone, upstairs in his hotel room, where no one could see him.
"I have to get away,"
he said to himself.
"I've got to be by myself. Why?"
he wondered. He did not know. It had invaded him as an instinct, non-rational, impossible to understand or explain.
"I'll go get a doctor,"
Denny said.
"Pat, you stay here with him. Don't let him out of your sight. I'll be back as soon as I can."
He started off. Joe dimly saw his retreating form. Denny appeared to shrink, to dwindle. and then he was entirely gone. Patricia Conley remained, but that did not make him feel less alone. His isolation, in spite of her physical presence, had become absolute.
"Well, Joe,"
she said,
"what do you want? What can I do for you? Just name it."
"The elevator,"
he said.
"You want me to lead you over to the elevator? I'll be glad to."
She started off, and as best he could, he followed. It seemed to him that she walked unusually fast. She did not wait, and she did not look back. He found it almost impossible to keep her in sight.
"Is it my imagination?"
he asked himself.
"That she's moving so rapidly?
It must be me. I'm slowed down, compressed by gravity."
His world had assumed the attribute of pure mass. He perceived himself in one mode only, that of an object subjected to the pressure of weight. One quality, one attribute, and one experience. Inertia.
"Not so fast,"
he said. He could not see her now. She had lithely trotted beyond his range of vision. Standing there, not able to move any farther, he panted. He felt his face drip and his eyes sting from the salty moisture.
"Wait,"
he said. Pat reappeared. He distinguished her face as she bent to peer at him, her perfect and tranquil expression, the disinterestedness of her attention, its scientific detachment.
"Want me to wipe your face?"
she asked. She brought out a handkerchief, small and dainty and lace-edged. She smiled, the same smile as before.
"Yes, get me into the elevator."
He compelled his body to move forward. One step, two. Now he could make out the elevator with several persons waiting for it. The old-fashioned dial above the sliding doors with its clock hand. The hand, the Baroque needle, wavered between three and four. It retired to the left, reaching the three, then wavered between three and two.
"It'll be here in a sec,"
Pat said. She got her cigarettes and lighter from her purse, lit up, exhaled trails of gray smoke from her nostrils.
"It's a very ancient kind of elevator,"
she said to him, her arms folded sedately.
"You know what I think? I think it's one of those old open iron cages. Do they scare you?"
The needle had passed two now. It hovered above one, then plunged down firmly. The doors slid aside. Joe saw the grill of the cage, the latticework. He saw the uniformed attendant seated on a stool, his hand on the rotating control.
"Going up," the attendant said. "Move to the back, please."
I'm not going to get into it,"
Joe said.
"Why not?"
Pat said.
"Do you think the cable will break? Is that what frightens you? I can see you're frightened."
It's what Al saw,"
he said.
"Well, Joe,"
Pat said,
"the only other way up to your room is the stairs, and you aren't going to be able to climb stairs. Not in your condition."
"I'll go up by the stairs."
He started away, seeking to locate the stairs.
"I can't see,"
he said to himself.
"I can't find them."
The weight on him crushed his lungs, making it difficult and painful to breathe. He had to halt, concentrating on getting air into him. That alone.
"Maybe it is a heart attack,"
he thought.
"I can't go up the stairs if it is."
But the longing within him had grown even greater, the overpowering need to be alone, locked in an empty room, entirely unwitnessed, silent and supine, stretched out, not needing to speak, not needing to move, not required to cope with anyone or any problem.
"And no one will ever know where I am,"
he told himself. That seemed unaccountably very important. He wanted to be unknown and invisible, to live unseen.
"Pat, especially,"
he thought.
"Not her. She can't be near me."
"There we are,"
Pat said. She guided him, turning him slightly to the left.
"Right in front of you. Just take hold of the railing and go bump-de-bump upstairs to bed. See?"
She ascended skillfully, dancing and twinkling, poising herself, then scrambling weightlessly to the next step.
Can you make it?
Joe said,
I don't want you to come with me.
Oh, dear.
She cluck-clucked with mock dolefulness. Her black eyes shone.
Are you afraid I'll take advantage of your condition? Do something to you? Something harmful?
No.
He shook his head.
I just want to be alone.
Gripping the rail, he managed to pull himself up onto the first step. Halting there, he gazed up, trying to make out the top of the flight, trying to determine how far away it was, how many steps he had left.
Mr. Denny asked me to stay with you. I can read to you, or get you things. I can wait on you.
He climbed another step.
Alone,
he gasped. Pat said,
May I watch you climb? I'd like to see how long it takes you, assuming you make it at all.
I'll make it.
He placed his foot on the next step, gripped the railing, and hoisted himself up. His swollen heart choked off his throat. He shut his eyes and wheezed in strangled air.
I wonder, Pat said, if this is what Wendy did. She was the first, right?
Joe gasped.
I was in love with her.
Oh, I know. Gigi Ashwood told me. He read your mind. Gigi and I got to be very good friends. We spent a lot of time together. You might say we had an affair. Yes, you could say that.
Our theory,
Joe said,
was right.
He took a deeper breath.
One,
he succeeded in saying. He ascended another step, and then, with tremendous effort, another.
That you and Gigi worked it out with Ray Hollis to infiltrate.
Quite right,
Pat agreed.
Our best inertials and Runciter wipe us all out.
He made his way up one more step.
We're not in Half-Life. We're not.
Oh, you can die,
Pat said.
You're not dead. Not you, in particular, I mean. But you are dying off one by one. But why talk about it? Why bring it up again? You said it all a little while ago, and frankly, you bore me going over it again and again. You're really a very dull, pedantic person, Joe. Almost as dull as Wendy Wright. You two would have made a good pair.
That's why Wendy died first,
he said.
Not because she had separated from the group, but because...
He cringed as the pain in his heart throbbed up violently. He had tried for another step, but this time he had missed. He stumbled, then found himself seated, huddled like...
Yes,
he thought.
Wendy in the closet, huddled like this.
Reaching out his hand, he took hold of the sleeve of his coat. He tugged. The fabric tore. Dried and starved, the material parted like cheap gray paper. It had no strength, like something fashioned by wasps. So there was no doubt about it. He would soon be leaving a trail behind him. Bits of crumbled cloth, a trail of debris leading to a hotel room, and yearned for isolation. His last labored actions governed by a tropism, an orientation urging him toward death, decay, and non-being. A dismal alchemy controlled him, culminating in the grave. He ascended another step.
I'm gonna make it,
he realized.
The force goading me on is feasting on my body. That's why Wendy and Al and Edie, and undoubtedly Zasky by now, deteriorated physically as they died, leaving only a discarded, husk-like, weightless shell, containing nothing. No essence, no juices, no substantial density. The force thrust itself against the weight of many gravities. And this is the cost, this using up of the waning body. But the body, as a source supply, will be enough to get me up there. A biological necessity is at work, I'm probably at this point not even Pat, who set it into motion, can abort it.
He wondered how she felt now as she watched him climb. Did she admire him? Did she feel contempt? He raised his head, searched for her. He made her out, her vital face with its several hues. Only interest there. No malevolence. A neutral expression. He did not feel surprise. Pat had made no move to hinder him and no move to help him. It seemed right, even to him.
Feel any better? Pat asked.
Oh,
he said, and getting halfway up, lunged onto the next step.
You look different. Not so upset.
Joe said,
because I can make it. I know that.
It's not much further, Pat agreed.
Farther,
he corrected.
You're incredible. So trivial. So small. Even in your own death spasms, you...
She corrected herself, cat-like and clever.
Or what probably seems subjectively to you as death spasms. I shouldn't have used that term, death spasms. It might depress you. Try to be optimistic, okay?
Just tell me, he said. How many steps left?
6?
She slid away from him, gliding upward noiselessly, effortlessly.
No, sorry, 10. Or is it 9? I think it's 9.
Again he climbed a step, then the next, and the next. He did not talk. He did not even try to see. Going by the hardness of the surface against which he rested, he crept snail-like from step to step, feeling a kind of skill develop in him, an ability to tell exactly how to exert himself, how to use his nearly bankrupt power.
Almost there, Pat said cheerily from above him. What do you have to say, Joe? Any comments on your great climb? The greatest climb in the history of man? No, that's not true. Wendy and Al and Edie and Fred Zavsky did it before you. But this is the only one I've actually watched.
Joe said,
Why me?
I want to watch you, Joe, because of your low-class little scheme back in Zurich. Of having Wendy Wright spend the night with you in your hotel room. Now, tonight, this will be different. You'll be alone.
That night, too,
Joe said.
I was alone.
Another step. He coughed convulsively, and out of him, in drops, hurled from his streaked face, his remaining capacity expelled itself uselessly.
She was there. Not in your bed, but in the room somewhere. You slept through it, though.
Pat laughed.
I'm trying,
Joe said.
Not to cough.
He made it up 2 more steps and knew that he had almost reached the top. How long had he been on the stairs, he wondered. No way for him to tell. He discovered then, with a shock, that he had become cold as well as exhausted.
When did this happen?
He asked himself. Sometime in the past. It had infiltrated so gradually that before now he had not noticed it.
Oh, God,
he said to himself, and shivered frantically. His bones seemed almost to quake. Worse than on Luna. Far worse. Worse, too, than the chill which had hung over his hotel room in Zurich. Those had been harbingers.
Metabolism,
he reflected,
is a burning process. An active furnace. When it ceases to function, life is over. They must be wrong about hell,
he said to himself.
Hell is cold. Everything there is cold. The body means weight and heat. Now weight is a force which I am succumbing to. And heat, my heat, is slipping away. And unless I become reborn, it will never return. This is the destiny of the universe. So, at least I won't be alone.
But he felt alone.
It's overtaking me too soon, he realized. The proper time hasn't come. Something has hurried this up. Some conniving thing has accelerated it out of malice and curiosity. A polymorphic, perverse agency which likes to watch. An infantile, retarded entity which enjoys what's happening. It has crushed me like a bent-legged insect,
he said to himself.
A simple bug, which does nothing but hug the earth, which can never fly or escape, can only descend step by step into what is deranged and foul. Into the world of the tomb, which a perverse entity surrounded by its own filth inhabits, the thing we call Pat.
Do you have your key? Pat asked. To your room? Think how awful you'd feel to get up to the second floor and find you'd lost your key and couldn't get into your room.
I have it.
He groped in his pockets. His coat ripped away, tattered and in shreds. It fell from him, and from its top pocket, the key slid. It fell 2 steps down below him, beyond reach. Pat said briskly,
I'll get it for you.
Darting by him, she scooped up the key, held it to the light to examine it, then laid it at the top of the flight of stairs, on the railing.
Right up here, she said, where you can reach it when you're through climbing. Your reward. The room, I think, is to the left, about 4 doors down the hall. You'll have to move slowly, but it'll be a lot easier once you're off the stairs, once you don't have to climb.
I can see, he said. The key and the top. I can see the top of the stairs.
With both arms grasping the banister, he dragged himself upward, ascended 3 steps in 1 agonizing expenditure of himself. He felt it deplete him. The weight on him grew, the cold grew, and the substantiality of himself waned. But he had reached the top.
Goodbye, Joe, Pat said.
She hovered over him, kneeling slightly so that he could see her face.
You don't want Don Denny bursting in, do you? A doctor won't be able to help you, so I'll tell him that I got the hotel people to call a cab and that you're on your way across town to a hospital. That way, you won't be bothered. You can be entirely by yourself. Do you agree?
Yes,
he said.
Here's the key.
She pushed the cold metal thing into his hand, closed his fingers about it.
Keep your chin up, as they say here in 39. Don't take any wooden nickels. They say that, too.
She slipped away then, onto her feet. For an instant, she stood there, scrutinizing him, and then she darted off down the hall to the elevator. He saw her press the button. Wait. He saw the doors slide open. And then Pat disappeared. Gripping the key, he rose lurchingly to a crouched position. He balanced himself against the far wall of the corridor, then turned to the left and began to walk step by step, still supporting himself by means of the wall.
Darkness,
he thought.
It isn't lit.
He squeezed his eyes shut, opened them, blinked. Sweat from his face still blinded him, still stung. He could not tell if the corridor were genuinely dark or whether his power of sight was fading out. By the time he reached the first door, he had been reduced to crawling. He tilted his head up, sought for the number on the door.
No, not this one.
He crept on. When he found the proper door, he had to stand erect, propped up, to insert the key in the lock. The effort finished him. The key still in his hand, he fell. His head struck the door, and he flopped back onto the dust-choked carpet, smelling the odor of age and wear and frigid death.
I can't get into the room,
he realized.
I can't stand up anymore.
But he had to. Out here, he could be seen. Gripping the knob with both hands, he tugged himself onto his feet 1 more time. He rested his weight entirely against the door as he tremblingly poked the key in the direction of the knob and the lock. This way, once he had turned the key, the door would fall open and he would be inside.
And then,
he thought,
if I can close the door after me, and if I can get to the bed, it'll be over.
The lock grated. The metal unit hauled itself back. The door opened and he pitched forward, arms extended. The floor rose toward him and he made out shapes in the carpet, swirls and designs and floral entities in red and gold, but worn into roughness and lusterlessness. The colors had dimmed, and as he struck the floor, feeling little, if any, pain, he thought,
"This is very old. This room. When this place was first built, they probably did use an open iron cage for an elevator. So I saw the actual elevator,"
he said to himself.
"The authentic, original one."
He lay for a time, and then, as if called, summoned into motion, stirred. He lifted himself up onto his knees, placed his hands flat before him.
"My hands,"
he thought.
"Good God. Parchment hands, yellow and knobby, like the ass of a cooked dry turkey. Bristly skin, not like human skin. Pin feathers. As if I've devolved back millions of years to something that flies and coasts, using its skin as a sail."
Opening his eyes, he searched for the bed. He strove to identify it. The fat far window admitting gray light through its web of curtains. A vanity table, ugly with lank legs. Then the bed, with brass knobs capping its railed sides, bent and irregular, as if years of use had twisted the railings, warped the varnished wooden headboards.
"I want to get on it even so,"
he said to himself. He reached toward it, slid and dragged himself farther into the room. And saw then a figure seated in an overstuffed chair, facing him. A spectator who had made no sound, but who now stood up, and came rapidly toward him. Glenn Runciter.
"I couldn't help you climb the stairs,"
Runciter said, his heavy face stern.
"She would have seen me. Matter of fact, I was afraid she'd come all the way into the room with you, and then we'd be in trouble because she..."
He broke off, bent and hoisted Joe up to his feet as if Joe had no weight left in him, no remaining material constituents.
"We'll talk about that later. Here."
He carried Joe under his arm, across the room, not to the bed, but to the overstuffed chair in which he himself had been sitting.
"Can you hold on a few seconds longer?"
Runciter asked.
"I want to shut and lock the door, in case she changes her mind."
"Yes,"
Joe said. Runciter strode in three big steps to the door, slammed it and bolted it, came at once back to Joe. Opening a drawer of the vanity table, he hastily brought out a spray can with bright stripes, balloons and lettering glorifying its shiny surfaces.
"Ubik,"
Runciter said. He shook the can mightily, then stood before Joe, aiming it at him.
"Don't thank me for this,"
he said, and sprayed prolongedly left and right. The air flickered and shimmered, as if bright particles of light had been released, as if the sun's energy sparkled here in this worn-out, elderly hotel room.
"Feel better? It should work on you right away. You should already be getting a reaction."
He eyed Joe with anxiety. 14.
It takes more than a bag to seal in food flavor. It takes Ubik plastic wrap, actually four layers in one. Keeps freshness in, air and moisture out. Watch this simulated test.
"Do you have a cigarette?"
Joe said. His voice shook, but not from weariness, nor from cold. Both had gone.
"I'm tense," he said to himself. "But I'm not dying. That process has been stopped by the Ubik spray. As Runciter said it would,"
he remembered,
"in his taped TV commercial. If I could find it, I'd be all right. Runciter promised that. But,
he thought somberly,
it took a long time, and I almost didn't get to it.
No filter tips,
Runciter said.
They don't have filtration devices on their cigarettes in this backward no-good time period.
He held a pack of Camels toward Joe.
I'll light it for you.
He struck a match and extended it.
Oh, it's fresh,
Joe said.
Oh, hell yes. Christ, I just now bought it downstairs at the tobacco counter. We're a long way into this. Well past the stage of clotted milk and stale cigarettes.
He grinned starkly, his eyes determined and bleak, reflecting no light.
In it,
he said.
Not out of it. There's a difference.
He lit a cigarette for himself, too. Leaning back, he smoked in silence, his expression still grim. And, Joe decided, tired. But not the kind of tiredness that he himself had undergone. Joe said,
Can you help the rest of the group?
I have exactly one can of this Ubik. Most of it I had to use on you.
He gestured with resentment, his fingers convulsed in a tremor of unresigned anger.
My ability to alter things here is limited. I've done what I could.
His head jerked as he raised his eyes to glare at Joe.
I got through to you, all of you, every chance I could, every way I could. I did everything that I had the capacity to bring about. Damn little. Almost nothing.
He lapsed then into smoldering, brooding silence.
The graffiti on the bathroom walls, Joe said. You wrote that we were dead and you were alive.
I am alive.
Runciter rasped.
Are we dead? The rest of us?
After a long pause, Runciter said,
Yes.
But in the tape TV commercial,
that was for the purpose of getting you to fight, to find Ubik. It made you look, and you kept on looking, too. I kept trying to get it to you, but you know what went wrong. She kept drawing everyone into the past. She worked on us all with that talent of hers. Over and over again, she regressed it and made it worthless.
Runciter added,
Except for the fragmentary notes I managed to slip to you in conjunction with the stuff.
Urgently, he pointed his heavy, determined finger at Joe, gesturing with vigor.
Look what I've been up against. The same thing that got all of you, that's killed you off one by one. Frankly, it's amazing to me that I was able to do as much as I could.
Joe said,
When did you figure out what was taking place? Did you always know? From the start?
The start.
Runciter echoed, bitingly.
What's that mean? It started months, or maybe even years ago. God knows how long Hollis and Mick and Pat Conley and S. Dole Melipone and G.G. Ashwood have been hatching it up, working it over and reworking it like dough. Here's what happened. We got lured to Luna. We let Pat Conley come with us, a woman we didn't know, a talent we didn't understand, which possibly even Hollis doesn't understand. An ability, anyhow, connected with time reversion. Not, strictly speaking, the ability to travel through time. For instance, she can't go into the future. In a certain sense, she can't go into the past, either. What she does, as near as I can comprehend it, is start a counter-process that uncovers the prior stages inherent in configurations of matter. But you know that. You and Al figured it out.
He ground his teeth with wrath.
Al Hammond, what a loss. But I couldn't do anything. I couldn't break through then as I've done now.
Why were you able to now?
Joe asked. Runciter said,
Because this is as far back as she is able to carry us. Normal forward flow has already resumed. We're again flowing from past into present into future. She evidently stretched her ability to its limit. 1939. That's the limit. What she's done now is shut off her talent. Why not? She's accomplished what Ray Hollis sent her to us to do.
How many people have been affected?
Just the group of us who were on Luna there in that subsurface room. Not even Zoe Wirt. Pat can circumscribe the range of the field she creates. As far as the rest of the world is concerned, the bunch of us took off for Luna and got blown up in an accidental explosion. We were put into cold pack by Solicitus Stanton Mick, but no contact could be established. They didn't get us soon enough.
Joe said, "Why wouldn't the bomb blast be enough?" Lifting an eyebrow, Runciter regarded him.
"Why use Pat Connolly at all?"
Joe said. He sensed, even in his weary, shaken state, something wrong.
There's no reason for all this reversion machinery, this sinking us into a retrograde time momentum back here to 1939. It serves no purpose.
That's an interesting point,
Runciter said. He nodded slowly, a frown on his rugged, stony face.
I'll have to think about it. Give me a little while.
He walked to the window, stood gazing out at the stores across the street.
It strikes me, Joe said, that what we appear to be faced with is a malignant rather than a purposeful force. Not so much someone trying to kill us or nullify us, someone trying to eliminate us from functioning as a prudence organization. But,
he pondered, he almost had it.
An irresponsible entity that's enjoying what it's doing to us, the way it's killing us off one by one. It doesn't have to prolong all this. That doesn't sound to me like Ray Hollis. He deals in cold, practical murder. And for what I know about Stanton Mick...
Pat herself!
Runciter interrupted brusquely. He turned away from the window.
She's psychologically a sadistic person, like tearing wings off flies, playing with us.
He watched for Joe's reaction. Joe said,
It sounds to me more like a child.
But look at Pat Connolly. She's spiteful and jealous. She got Wendy first because of emotional animosity. She followed you all the way up the stairs just now, enjoying it, gloating over it, in fact.
How do you know that?
Joe said.
You were waiting here in this room, he said to himself. You couldn't have seen it. And
how had Runciter known he would come to this particular room? Letting out his breath in a ragged, noisy rush, Runciter said,
I haven't told you all of it. As a matter of fact,
he ceased speaking, chewed his lower lip savagely, then abruptly resumed.
What I've said hasn't been strictly true. I don't hold the same relationship to this regressed world that the rest of you do. You're absolutely right. I know too much. It's because I enter it from outside, Joe.
Manifestations, Joe said.
Yes. Thrust down into this world, here and there, at strategic points and times, like the traffic citation. Like Archer's.
You didn't tape that TV commercial, Joe said. That was live.
Runciter, with reluctance, nodded.
Why the difference, Joe said, between your situation and ours?
You want me to say?
Yes.
He prepared himself, already knowing what he would hear.
I'm not dead, Joe. The graffiti told the truth. You're all in cold pack, and I'm...
Runciter spoke with difficulty, not looking directly at Joe.
I'm sitting in a consultation lounge at the Beloved Brethren Moratorium. All of you are interwired on my instructions, kept together as a group. I'm out here trying to reach you. That's where I am when I say I'm outside. That's why the manifestations, as you call them... For 1 week now, I've been trying to get you all functioning in half-life, but it isn't working. You're fading out one by one.
After a pause, Joe said,
What about Pat Conley?
Yeah, she's with you, in Half-Life, interwired to the rest of the group.
Are the regressions due to her talent, or to the normal decay of Half-Life?
Tensely, he waited for Runciter's answer. Everything, as he saw it, hung on this one question. Runciter snorted, grimaced, then said hoarsely,
The normal decay. Ella experienced it. Everyone who enters Half-Life experiences it.
You're lying to me, Joe said, and felt a knife shear through him.
Staring at him, Runciter said,
Joe, my God, I saved your life. I broke through to you enough just now to bring you back into full Half-Life functioning. You'll probably go on indefinitely now. If I hadn't been waiting here in this hotel room when you came crawling through that door, why, hell, hey, look, goddammit, you'd be lying on that rundown bed dead as a doornail by now if it wasn't for me. I'm Glenn Runciter. I'm your boss, and I'm the one fighting to save all your lives. I'm the only one out here in the real world plugging for you.
He continued to stare at Joe with heated indignation and surprise. A bewildered, injured surprise, as if he could not fathom what was happening.
That girl, Runciter said. That Pat Conley. She would have killed you, like she killed...
He broke off. Joe said, Like she killed Wendy and Al, Edie Dorn, Fred Zaski, and maybe by now Tito Apostos.
In a low but controlled voice, Runciter said,
This situation is very complex, Joe. It doesn't admit to simple answers.
You don't know the answers, Joe said. That's the problem. You made up answers. You had to invent them to explain your presence here. All your presences here, your so-called manifestations.
I don't call them that. You and Al worked out that name. Don't blame me for what you two...
You don't know any more than I do, Joe said, about what's happening to us and who's attacking us. Glenn, you can't say who we're up against because you don't know.
Runciter said,
I know I'm alive. I know I'm sitting out here in this consultation lounge at the moratorium.
Your body in the coffin, Joe said. Here at the Simple Shepherd Mortuary. Did you look at it?
No, Runciter said. But that isn't really...
It had withered, Joe said. Lost bulk like Wendy's and Al's and Edie's. And in a little while, mine. Exactly the same for you. No better, no worse.
In your case, I got Ubik.
Again, Runciter broke off. A difficult-to-decipher expression appeared on his face. A combination, perhaps, of insight, fear, and... But Joe couldn't tell.
I got you the Ubik,
he finished.
What is Ubik? Joe said.
There was no answer from Runciter.
You don't know that either, Joe said. You don't know what it is or why it works. You don't even know where it comes from.
After a long, agonized pause, Runciter said,
You're right, Joe. Absolutely right.
Tremulously, he lit another cigarette.
But I wanted to save your life. That part's true. Hell, I'd like to save all your lives.
The cigarette slipped from his fingers. It dropped to the floor, rolled away. With labored effort, Runciter bent over to grope for it. On his face showed extreme and clear-cut unhappiness, almost a despair.
We're in this, Joe said. And you're sitting out there, out in the lounge, and you can't do it. You can't put a stop to the thing we're involved in.
That's right,
Runciter nodded.
This is Coldback,
Joe said.
But there's something more. Something not natural to people in Half-Life. There are two forces at work, as Al figured out. One helping us and one destroying us. You're working with the force or entity or person that's trying to help us. You got the Ubik from them.
Yes,
Joe said.
So none of us know even yet who it is that's destroying us, and who it is that's protecting us. You outside don't know, and we in here don't know. Maybe it's Pat.
I think it is, Runciter said. I think there's your enemy.
Joe said,
almost, but I don't think so. I don't think, he said to himself, that we've met our enemy face to face, or our friend either.
He thought,
but I think we will. Before long, we will know who they both are. Are you sure?
He asked Runciter.
Absolutely sure that you're beyond doubt the only one who survived the blast. Think before you answer.
Like I said, Zoe Wirt
of us, Joe said. She's not here in this time segment with us. Pat Conley, for example.
Pat Conley's chest was crushed. She died of shock and a collapsed lung with multiple internal injuries, including a damaged liver and a leg broken in three places. Physically speaking, she's about 4 feet away from you. Her body, I mean.
And it's the same for all the rest?
They're all here in Colpack at the Beloved Brethren Moratorium, Runciter said.
With one exception, Sammy Mundo. He suffered massive brain damage and lapsed into a coma, out of which they say he'll never emerge. The cortical...
Then he's alive. He's not in Colpack. He's not here.
I wouldn't call it alive. They've run encephalograms on him. No cortical activity at all. A vegetable, nothing more. No personality, no motion, no consciousness. There's nothing happening in Mundo's brain. Nothing in the slightest.
Joe said,
so, therefore, you naturally didn't think to mention it.
I mentioned it now, when I asked you.
He reflected.
How far is he from us? In Zurich?
We sat down here in Zurich, yes. He's at the Carl Jung Hospital, about a quarter mile from this moratorium.
Rent a telepath, Joe said, or use G.G. Ashwood. Have him scanned. A boy, he said to himself. Disorganized and immature. A cruel, unformed, peculiar personality. This may be it, he said to himself. It would fit in with what we're experiencing. The capricious, contradictory happenings. The pulling off of our wings and then the putting back. The temporary restorations, as in just now with me here in this hotel room, after my climb up the stairs.
Runciter sighed.
We did that. In brain injury cases like this, it's a regular practice to try to reach the person telepathically. No results. Nothing. No frontal lobe cerebration of any sort. Sorry, Joe.
He wagged his massive head in a sympathetic, tick-like motion. Obviously, he shared Joe's disappointment. Removing the plastic disc from its place, its firm adhesion to his ear, Glenn Runciter said into the microphone,
I'll talk to you again later.
He now set down all the communications apparatus, rose stiffly from the chair, and momentarily stood facing the misty, immobile, ice-bound shape of Joe Chip, resting within its transparent plastic casket, upright and silent, as it would be for the rest of eternity.
Did you ring for me, sir?
Herbert Schoenheit von Vogelsang scuttled into the consultation lounge, cringing like a medieval toady.
Shall I put Mr. Chip back with the others? You're done, sir?
Runciter said,
I'm done.
Did you?
Yes, I got through all right. We could hear each other fine this time.
He lit a cigarette. It had been hours since he had had one, had found a free moment. By now, the arduous, prolonged task of reaching Joe Chip had depleted him.
Do you have an amphetamine dispenser nearby?
He asked the moratorium owner.
In the hall, outside the consultation lounge.
The eager-to-please creature pointed. Leaving the lounge, Runciter made his way to the amphetamine dispenser. He inserted a coin, pushed the choice lever, and, into the drop slot, a small, familiar object slid with a tinkling sound. The pill made him feel better, but then he thought about his appointment with Len Nigelman 2 hours from now, and wondered if he could really make it.
There's been too much going on,
he decided.
I'm not ready to make my formal report to the Society. I'll have to vid Niggleman and ask for a postponement.
Using a payphone, he called Niggleman back in the North American